a dramatic sting in The Hague today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Four Russian hackers flew into the Netherlands on diplomatic passports. Dutch law enforcement caught them red-handed in a hotel parking lot.
And they were caught with the trunk of their car popped open, and they had a whole bunch of gear back in there. They had laptops and special antennas. They had equipment that is used to hack into a network.
At that moment, the Dutch swooped in and picked them up.
And as they did this, the guys tried to destroy some of the equipment, including the cell phones they had with them. It's going to be a long time before you hear details like this coming out of a Western intelligence agency.
That and other tales of Russian cyber warfare coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you here. Both Russia and China are under the spotlight today as serious threats to American national security, in different ways, though, and in a few minutes we'll get to which one represents the more serious threat to the U.S. Today we saw an extraordinary full-court press from both sides of the Atlantic against cyber attacks by Russia.
The GRU is an aggressive, well-funded, official body of the Russian state. It can no longer be allowed to act aggressively across the world.
It is evident from the allegations in today's indictment that the defendants believe that they could use their anonymity to act with impunity, to undermine international institutions, and to distract from their government's own wrongdoing. They were wrong.
Officials there speaking at two separate news conferences, one in Washington, the other in The Hague in the Netherlands. Both pressers detailed how Russian intelligence officers launched cyber attacks against targets in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. A wide variety of targets involving everything from a nuclear power company in Pennsylvania to agencies looking into Russian doping in sports. Anthony Deutsch is the Netherlands bureau chief for Reuters. He was at the press conference today in The Hague. There are a lot of layers to this. Can we just start with the targets? What have we learned from the Netherlands, the UK, and the US about who was targeted and why?
It was described as the uncovering of a global conspiracy. They said that this Russian military intelligence unit had targeted everything from a U.S. nuclear power company, Westinghouse, to anti-doping organizations, dozens of them all over the world, from Brazil to Lausanne in Switzerland and the FIFA Global Soccer Organization to the international investigation into the MH17 airliner crash, all the way to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in The Hague, which was the moment when the Dutch intelligence got wind of this operation.
That's a lot of diverse targets. Was there any announcement of motive or why the Russians are alleged to have conducted these operations?
They started around the time of the Summer Olympics in Brazil back in 2016. Russia was trying to retaliate after its athletes were banned from taking part in the games. Other motives are that it was an ally with Syria, where the chemical weapons organization had launched an investigation, and also the investigation by the same organization in Salisbury, where a former Russian spy was poisoned with his daughter earlier this year. So a lot of ground covered by these four intelligence agents who are exposed today.
One piece of this story, I got to say, I mean, this is a cliche, but it does read like a spy thriller. Dutch law enforcement caught the Russian GRU agents red-handed trying to hack into the Hague's Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Can you just walk us through what happened?
Absolutely. If you had been sitting there, you would have thought you had been caught up in a thriller. They said that they first discovered these four men on the 10th of April. And you have to picture the context here. This is a few weeks after the poisoning of this former Russian agent in this English village. These four men flew from Moscow to Amsterdam Airport on April 10th. They all had diplomatic passports. The Dutch intelligence today distributed photographs of these guys, including their passport numbers, their photographs, everything. And you could see from the documentation that the passport numbers only differed by one digit. So saying these guys were issued special diplomatic passports. Wow. For this trip. Once they arrived in Amsterdam, they rented a Citroën and drove to The Hague, where the Chemical Weapons Organization is based. And they checked into a hotel there, a Marriott hotel. And the moment they were caught red-handed was they were in the parking lot of the hotel where they had taken the trash out of their hotel room. And they were caught with the trunk of their car popped open, and they had a whole bunch of gear back in there. They had laptops. They had equipment that is used to hack into a network. So they were trying to steal the passwords of staff of the Chemical Weapons Organization so that they could then log on to their network. Now, this is the moment where the Dutch kind of swooped in, caught these guys and picked them up. And as they did this, the guys tried to destroy some of the equipment, including the cell phones, so they knew they'd been had.
Where are these men now? Do we know?
So what happened is the Dutch then detained these guys and they threw them out of the country. The military intelligence didn't have an arrest warrant or there was no indictment against them. So they said they're believed all to be back in Russia.
You know, I'm thinking about some of the aspects of this story of the Russian hack into The Hague's OPCW. Should we be surprised that the Dutch government, presumably with the blessing of the British government, they're providing this level of detail in an intelligence investigation?
I mean, these kinds of details, it's going to be a long time before you hear details like this coming out of probably any Western intelligence agency. What's been happening is every time that Russia comes up as being involved, for example, in the Salisbury poisoning, every time that Russia is even remotely linked to any of these activities, they just retaliate with countless smoke screens and try to distort information. So what I think they were attempting to do today is provide such irrefutable detail, releasing copies of these guys' passports, pictures of the car they had rented with the license plate, pictures of the equipment that they had used. It's really an amount of detail that would never be released because they don't want to expose how they operate or how much they know. And I think they just wanted to show, look, we've got you, we caught you red-handed, deny this. And Dutch intelligence mentioned kind of a very elaborate and close cooperation between intelligence agencies across the globe. This type of cooperation and type of coordination, the collective condemnation of activities of the Russian military intelligence, kind of sets a stage for ramping up political tensions and deteriorating already very poor diplomatic relations.
Anthony Deutsch, Bureau Chief for Reuters in the Netherlands, speaking with us from The Hague. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Now on to China, the other country being talked about in the news today as a national security threat. Today in Washington, Vice President Mike Pence took direct aim at Beijing. He was speaking at a conservative think tank. Pence accused China of meddling in the upcoming U.S. midterm elections. He essentially told the Chinese government to butt out of domestic American politics. And that wasn't the only warning he had for Beijing, as the world's Matthew Bell reports.
The vice president picked up where President Trump left off when he spoke at the United Nations in New York last week. Trump had said that China was meddling in the American democratic system, trying to influence U.S. voters and undermine the Republicans in the midterm elections. Today, Mike Pence told his audience at the Hudson Institute that this administration is doing something previous ones failed to do, and that's stand up to China's unfair trade practices. Beijing doesn't like it, Pence said. And it's responding with a coordinated campaign.
China has initiated an unprecedented effort to influence American public opinion, the 2018 elections, and the environment leading into the 2020 presidential elections. To put it bluntly, President Trump's leadership is working, and China wants a different American president.
Pence said China is pressuring American businesses, movie studios, think tanks, and government officials. It's using front groups, covert operations, and propaganda, he said, to manipulate American public opinion.
As a senior career member of our intelligence community told me just this week, what the Russians are doing pales in comparison to what China is doing across this country. And the American people deserve to know it.
Pence did not offer detailed new evidence, but he did mention a Chinese Communist Party document that he said outlines Beijing's efforts to play up political divisions in the U.S. by highlighting wedge issues like trade tariffs. Pence's speech was in part a reflection of reality, says Steve Tsang. He's the director of the China Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. The reality is that U.S.-China relations are in a bad place.
There is a almost, if you like, climate change in the way how the United States is looking at relationship with China. We're not looking at local change in weather. We're looking at a climatic change.
And Tsang says things are likely to get worse because the trade war is not something that can be negotiated away in a matter of weeks or months. As for the allegations about Chinese meddling in U.S. democracy, Tsang says some of it's true.
Such as the placing of advertising materials in newspaper in certain American states. But that is rather different from the allegations of the Chinese interfering into the midterm electoral process or doing something which the Russians appear to have done with the 2016 elections. I have not seen anything that would amount to credible evidence to suggest the Chinese are trying to do that.
Vice President Pence today said what the Russians are doing pales in comparison to what China is doing. Does that seem unfair to you?
It comes across to me as if the Trump administration is trying to divert attention from the Russian intervention into the U.S. electoral process and turn it towards China.
Pence's speech today was wide-ranging. He talked about Taiwan, about human rights and religious freedom, about intellectual property theft and the standoff in the South China Sea. Bonnie Glaser at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says it reminded her of Ronald Reagan's 1983 Evil Empire speech aimed at the Soviet Union.
The Trump administration is going, I think, to throw the book at China, and Vice President Pence's speech may be just the beginning.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
So far today, we've heard about attacks from Russia and the threat from China, and I'm about to ask a question that feels like we're back in the days of the Cold War. Which is worse, Russia or China? I'm going to get a quick hit on this from Heather Hurlburt with the New America Foundation. Heather, between Russia and China, which is the most immediate threat to U.S. national security generally, and why?
So look, international relations professionals hate this question. It's the equivalent of which of your children would you save? But China is the bigger long-term threat because it's the bigger economy and stronger, more cohesive society. Russia's the more immediate threat because Putin needs wins against the U.S. to stack up his own domestic legitimacy. So the U.S. has to, in a way, be able to stave off Russia's relentless probing of our institutions and social cohesion in order to be able to deal with China in the long run.
Yeah. And is the U.S. doing kind of the right things in terms of national security right now in addressing the long-term threat of China?
Well, the funny thing about Russia and China is that in some ways they're the same long-term threat, which is autocratic societies looking to see if they can use the tools and technology of our open society to undermine it and protect their own more closed societies. So, you know, in some ways, the things we're not doing to push back against Russia right now, strengthening our voting infrastructure, strengthening our institutions, figuring out how to have a cohesive society, signaling to Russia that there are consequences for what they're doing, those are also going to have negative effects against China in the longer term.
Am I framing the question with the right word? Is it threat? I mean, you know, Russia and China would say, you know, Russia's definitely denying a lot of this stuff, and China's like, what threat?
Look, do you like the idea that someone from another country can change the results of our elections? That's a threat.
Good enough. Very concise answer. Heather Hurlburt with the New America Foundation in Washington. Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Brazil has an election coming up this weekend, and guess what? Fake news and misinformation are a problem there, too. We'll hear how Facebook and a Brazilian fact-checking bot are fighting back here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If we want to protect the global climate, we need to protect the Amazon. That's the word from scientists who've been studying the forest's ability to capture CO2 pollution from the atmosphere and how that's starting to change. It's a story we've been focusing on this week here on The World. Today, reporter Sam Eaton visits with some of the people who've lived in the forest pretty much forever and who in some places are the last line of defense against deforestation.
You might well have heard the sound of a chainsaw in a story about Amazon deforestation 1,000 times. But this chainsaw in the Brazilian state of Maranhão isn't being used to cut down trees. It's being used to destroy a wooden timber hauler used by a band of illegal loggers. Claudio da Silva is a member of the Amazon's Guajajara tribe and the leader of an armed group of indigenous forest protectors called the Guardians of the Forest. Illegal logging and land clearing continue to eat away at the world's largest remaining tropical forest. But the Guardians and others like them in Brazil are pushing back. On a recent day this summer, Da Silva and the Guardians prepare to patrol the Caru River, a narrow strip of muddy water marking the boundary of the Guajajara's 700-square-mile forest reserve. The land is protected on paper, but it's under constant threat. If we go looking in our territory, Da Silva says, we always find illegal things going on. And sure enough, as we make our way up the river, Da Silva spots a dugout canoe pulled onto the bank on the Guajajara side. We pull up alongside it, jump out, and move quickly up a narrow path into the forest. There are fresh machete cuts in the brush. And then we hear voices of men coming toward us. The Guardians crouch down for an ambush with their rifles loaded. The Guardians shout out commands as three boys appear. Soon, the boys are kneeling with hands behind their heads. They're from the settlement across the river. The youngest is 14. They confess to cutting virgin timber to make charcoal, a valuable product in this impoverished region of Brazil. The Guardians eventually send the boys to their homes across the river with a message to the others. Don't come back. They were lucky this time that it was just some unarmed kids. This is a war, Da Silva says. The invaders want confrontation. The hunters, the loggers, the farmers, they're all armed. We can die at any time. Da Silva isn't exaggerating. Brazil has become the deadliest country in the world for land defenders like him, with more than 140 killings since 2015. And Maranhão, where the Guajajara live, is perhaps the most dangerous part of the country, with more attacks on indigenous groups here in 2016 than anywhere else. Just after this visit, the body of one of Da Silva's fellow guardians from an indigenous territory just south of here was found dumped along the riverbank. Da Silva himself has received dozens of death threats, but he says it's worth the risk. For the indigenous, he says, our wealth is the forest. It's not gold or whatever else is there. What we want is the forest itself. It's a wealth that extends far beyond the Guajajara's land and even the rest of the Amazon. Indigenous groups protecting their forest are providing an invaluable service for all of us, helping soften the impact of climate change.
56% of the carbon dioxide we are throwing into the atmosphere is removed back to the ocean and to the forests.
Carlos Nobre is a Brazilian climatologist.
So this is a tremendous ecosystem service. Very few people have a vague idea what that means, or even of its existence.
Or the fact that deforestation may be driving the entire Amazon and the services it provides to all of us to an alarming tipping point. After decades of sucking up huge amounts of CO2 pollution from the atmosphere, the process seems to have stopped, maybe even reversed. If that's happened, or when it does, that would mean the end of one of the planet's most powerful buffers against even more dangerous climate change. Many activists say indigenous groups like the Guajajara are the last best hope for saving the Amazon and other tropical forests. And there's evidence to back that up. Multiple scientific studies have found that the best way to protect forests is to empower the people who live in them. The studies say those efforts pay off with 2 to 3 times lower deforestation rates. They also produce billions of dollars worth of benefits from carbon sequestration, clean water, and more. But it's a David and Goliath battle. Protected indigenous lands cover nearly a quarter of the Amazon, and powerful economic forces are testing their resolve, from big ag, mining, and logging to the global demand for meat and soy. And they have allies in the Brazilian government. Congressman Nilson Leitão is a leader in the powerful agribusiness lobby called the Ruralistas. Leitão says Brazil shouldn't be protecting native lands from modern enterprise. Under his leadership, the ruralistas and their ally, President Michel Temer, have stopped the process for creating new indigenous reserves, defunded the agency charged with protecting the rights of indigenous people, and are pushing to open existing indigenous territories to agribusiness and mining. Most Indians, Letao says, live on government grants. Instead, he says, they should be able to exploit their land and make money. Brazil's indigenous groups generally see this rhetoric as self-serving, and they're fighting back. Last spring, more than 3,000 indigenous people descended on the capital, Brasilia, for a week of rallies and marches. It was the largest indigenous mobilization in Brazil's history. Sonia Guajajara, head of the Articulation of Indigenous Peoples of Brazil and a vice presidential candidate, organized the event.
A gente sempre viveu uma guerra no Brasil, né? O período de colonização foi marcado aí por...
We've always lived in a war in Brazil, she says. The colonization period was marked by deaths, murders, and extermination, and this hasn't stopped. It requires our constant resistance. Back at the Karu indigenous territory, Claudio da Silva calls the regional office of the military police for backup. The guardians have discovered a possible marijuana plantation on their land. Da Silva says confronting drug traffickers is the most dangerous kind of raid. The next day, 8 heavily armed policemen arrive. We enter the forest up the river and head up a path with assault rifles and bulletproof vests, checking for tripwires and booby traps. Before long, we find a planted field, but it's not pot. It's cassava, planted by land grabbers after they cleared the trees for charcoal. The guardians cut and burn the cassava, but the forest will take decades to recover. Sometimes when we see the trees cut down, Da Silva says, we feel rage. But we also have a heart, so sometimes we pity the outsiders, too. They wrecked what they had, Da Silva says, and now they want to wreck what we have. This is why we keep fighting, so this doesn't happen. For the world, Sam Eaton, Maranhão, Brazil.
Tomorrow, fighting deforestation by trying to make the standing forest more valuable. Our stories this week come from a partnership with The Nation magazine and the PBS NewsHour, with support from the Pulitzer Center and the Society of Environmental Journalists. We've got photos, video, and the rest of Sam's series at theworld.org/Amazon. I'm Marco Werman. What is Brazil doing to stop the spread of fake news ahead of their election? Meet their fact-checking bot, Fátima.
Olá, eu sou a Fátima, a robô checadora do Aos Fatos. Eu fui criada
Fátima versus fake news for a cleaner Brazilian election. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Facebook has come in for a lot of criticism for not acting fast enough to stop the spread of fake news and misleading information. So now Facebook is paying closer attention to election campaigns all over the world, like in Brazil, where the first round of presidential elections is scheduled for this weekend. In Rio de Janeiro, Catherine Osborne has our story.
In Rio, when a presidential debate is on the air, the Aos Fatos office turns into a war room. Aos Fatos means to the facts, and this fact-checking organization is furiously comparing the candidates' words with statistics. They've done this in the past, but what's new in this election is that Facebook will share their results through a messenger bot. The partnership is one of several that Facebook has made with Brazilian fact-checkers this election season.
The presidential election in Brazil is a top priority for Facebook.
That's Facebook's Monica Rosina on a call to reporters last month. Facebook says its own election monitoring war room in California is focusing on Brazil right now.
And we have been working really, really hard to protect the vote and encourage civic participation in what is Latin America's largest democracy.
Facebook has been criticized for its hands-off approach in past elections around the world, which let misinformation campaigns spread on its platforms. In Brazil, in the past 3 months, Facebook has taken down over 200 pages. Rosina says that included a network of fake accounts, sowing division, and misinformation. Meanwhile, Aos Fatos is programming its fact-checking results into a Facebook Messenger bot. The bot's name is Fátima.
Olá, eu sou a Fátima, a robô checadora do Aos Fatos.
You can talk to Fátima by pressing send message button.
This is Thay Nalon, the director of Aos Fatos. She explains users can find Fátima on Aos Fatos' page.
She will ask you if you want to fact check some kind of news or a WhatsApp hoax or even a video or an image.
Say you type the word video. Fátima will direct you to a site where you can do a special search to see if those images have been published by a legitimate source. And starting next week, if you send Fátima a link to something that Aos Fatos has already researched, she'll let you know if it checks out. Nalon says if this discourages someone from posting a questionable item, all the better.
If people don't share information they don't trust or they are not sure if it's true, it's already a progress.
In this country, where 66% of voters have WhatsApp accounts and 58% have Facebook accounts, false information can spread on social media like wildfire. And big tech platforms are taking slow steps to try to stop it. Twitter also repeatedly purges fake accounts in Brazil, and Google funds fact-checking initiatives. But some critics say these big tech platforms are still not doing enough.
If they have this machine of boosting content, they should be accountable for that.
This is Yasodhara Cordova, who researches online misinformation at Harvard's Shorenstein Center. I met her at a hotel in Rio where she was attending a conference. She says she wishes Facebook would make it clear why they take down some false information campaigns and not others, and who's behind them. Cordova is intimately familiar with hoaxes aimed at Brazilians because she's part of a group that fact-checks information sent around in WhatsApp groups. Sometimes the same hoaxes circulate for years, she says.
We have platforms that are not transparent, lack of good information, and we have people that are doing a terrible job in spreading good information.
Cordova's fact-checking group, Comprova, gets funding from Facebook and Google, which she says is a step in the right direction. But all of these initiatives still require users to opt in. You have to sign up for Comprova's notifications or seek out the fact-checking bots on Facebook. Still, in Brazil's elections, this imperfect fight against false information is gaining momentum. It's becoming more common for people to send in news items to be checked. And election authorities are on alert for misinformation, too. Thay Nalon says that attention from multiple stakeholders is important.
It's something like when we started to use emails and then came the virus, but now we know how to handle them. Fake news is something like that. It will still be there, and we have to build tools to try to live with it and try to separate what is true from what is false.
Nalon hopes what they're learning in Brazil can be applied in elections in other parts of the world. For The World, Catherine Osborne, Rio de Janeiro.
Here at home, midterm elections are just around the corner. People like Jonathan Morgan are closely watching social media for signs of disinformation campaigns targeting voters. Jonathan is founder and CEO of New Knowledge. It's a company that builds technologies to spot these campaigns. So far, he says they've seen action from both domestic and foreign players.
The foreign actors are the typical cast of characters: Russia, Iran, Israel. But here in the U.S., it's mostly political operatives. And I think this is where there's a really interesting question. The techniques are similar. They might be operating a network of websites, but doing it in a way that is opaque to the audience of those websites. So to that audience, it appears that there's dozens of publications and there's a consensus around important political issues amongst those publications, when in fact, it's not really a consensus. It's a few people orchestrating that message. And that might be amplified by thousands of social media accounts that are coordinating their activities. activity, either because they're automated like botnets or they're little armies of humans trying to spread a message intentionally as quickly and as broadly as possible. And so these are the characteristics that we associated with foreign influence operations, but they're, again, being done by folks who I think assume that they're just kind of hustling to get their message out as political operatives, even if it's a little shady or a little disingenuous.
And in terms of foreign actors, Russia doesn't surprise me, but what are Iran and Israel up to?
Very similar things. Similar to Russia, we see these networks of accounts focused on their foreign policy objectives. But what's interesting is that when there's a really contentious domestic issue here in the U.S., like the Kavanaugh nomination, for example, they do turn and focus on amplifying both sides of that issue, kind of sowing discord, which is, again, really similar to what we saw in 2016.
Are these campaigns targeting specific races in specific states?
Even in races that have been very high profile, for example, the Cruz-O'Rourke Senate race in Texas.
Right.
While there is a lot of social media engagement around that race, and there are some tactics being used, again, by, we think, domestic actors that are arguably manipulative, we're not seeing a lot of foreign amplification of one candidate or another in those races.
Generally, how would you say these operations right now compare to what we saw in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, both in terms of the end goal and the strategy, how it's actually done?
Well, we're seeing an evolution of tactics. So this is definitely an arms race. The social media platforms have improved their ability to detect certain types of tactics that we know are associated with foreign influence. But of course, new tactics are evolving. New proxies are being developed or new human assets are being cultivated so that foreign actors can operate through real Americans and obfuscate their activity. And in terms of strategy, I'd say that's been largely consistent from one election to the next. As much as there's been a huge focus on whether or not the Russian operation was focused on supporting the Trump campaign over the Clinton campaign, ultimately, I think what we've seen over the long term is that their real strategy was focusing on things that were very divisive. And of course, presidential elections are very divisive. Mm. And the more divisive they can make that conversation, the better. And the Kavanaugh nomination and the Me Too movement and the allegations of sexual assault, I think, of course, that's been a very – it's sort of an open wound for the country right now. So it's really no surprise that these accounts were trying to exacerbate that that discord.
Speaking of social media tactics, we just heard a story about Facebook working with fact checkers on the ground in Brazil to prevent the spread of disinformation as people there head to polls over the weekend, this coming weekend. Are Facebook and other social media companies doing the same kind of things here in the U.S.?
They are. And I think working with fact checkers is certainly one part of the solution. Of course, we want the information that gets disseminated online to be authentic and correct. But what we think about as disinformation is actually less about the truth or the authenticity of any given story and more about how it's distributed. Is the platform being manipulated to elevate one story or one narrative or one point of view over another? And I think that's where the social media platforms are also starting to work with third parties to identify this sort of manipulative distribution.
I just want to ask you about the news today, a Department of Justice charging 7 Russian military officials for hacking into anti-doping agencies and activists, as well as a Pennsylvania nuclear energy concern. It's kind of apples and oranges compared to what we're talking about, but it does suggest more Russian meddling. How do you see these charges against the concern of more apparent election meddling?
I think this is actually an indication that what we traditionally think about as cyber warfare and what we've started to think about as information warfare are actually one and the same. And the more that we think about these two things as being synonymous or overlapping, the more we'll be able to defend ourselves against these types of attacks in the future and thoughtfully engage with our adversaries around what is and isn't acceptable. What are the rules of the road in terms of this ongoing combat between nations that are sometimes friends and sometimes adversaries?
Jonathan Morgan is the CEO of New Knowledge. He also founded Data for Democracy, an organization that looks at ethics in the tech industry. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un both have said they're game for a second face-to-face meeting. Hard to imagine that just a year ago. There's another world leader who has said he wants a meeting with Kim, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. There's just one condition. North Korea has to come clean on something that still haunts Japan, the abduction of Japanese citizens in the 70s and 80s. Ibi Caputo recently spoke with the brother of one of the abductees about the fight for his sister's return.
Takuya Yokota was 9 years old in 1977 when his sister, Megumi, disappeared. She was 13.
It was in the evening. Usually she would have come home and we would have had dinner together. But that day, she didn't come home. My brother and I were watching TV, but no matter how long we waited, she did not come home.
Yokota and his brother eventually went out to look for Megumi. She'd had badminton practice that afternoon. They walked to the junior high school to see if she was still there. They even checked an abandoned building to see if maybe she was hiding.
We suspected maybe she had some kind of accident on her way home, or maybe she was involved in some incident or something terrible. We even wondered if she had killed herself, but there was just no clue whatsoever of what happened.
After that day, home became a very grim place.
I couldn't understand why she was not coming home. Seeing my mother and father, they looked so desolate. We didn't even know whether it was all right to ask them. And when we were at school, some of the other children would jeer at us and say, "Why is your sister missing?"
Megumi Yokota is one of the 17 Japanese citizens that Japan maintains were abducted by North Korean agents between 1977 and 1983. North Korea has acknowledged kidnapping 13 Japanese people in order to teach Japanese to North Korean spies. Five returned home in 2002. The others were said to be dead, including Yokota's sister. North Korea sent bones as proof, but the Japanese government claims these bones aren't hers. North Korea also issued a death certificate for Megumi. Her brother shows me a copy of it.
According
to this, my sister died in 1993. But the five abductees who were returned to Japan told us they saw her after that.
Yokota and his family are active in an association of relatives of the abducted Japanese. He says the North Koreans issued other fake death certificates, and they're all just childish lies. While relations between North Korea and the U.S. and South Korea continue to defrost, a rift remains between Tokyo and Pyongyang.
For sure, we are not saying that those who are really dead return to Japan.
Hitoshi Tanaka is a former deputy minister of foreign affairs. He's known for engineering the 2002 summit between the leaders of Japan and North Korea that led to the return of five of the abducted Japanese. I spoke with him this past summer, shortly after the meeting in Singapore between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And by the way, Tanaka is affiliated with the group that funded my reporting trip. He says what is needed is a thorough investigation into the whereabouts of all of the abductees.
People in Japan say that we cannot trust North Korea. North Korea may come up with false information, right? In that case, we need to be doing this investigation as a joint exercise.
North Korea opened an investigation in 2014 in exchange for lifting of Japanese sanctions. But less than 2 years later, Pyongyang shut it down after Japan reinstated sanctions following a North Korean rocket launch. As for Takuya Yokota, he says North Korea doesn't need to investigate.
They are the ones who abducted our family members, and they know exactly where these people are.
Yokota says the family members do not have any rights to diplomacy or military action. All they have, he says, are the power of words.
I think this is something everyone can understand. If something happened to your brother or sister or mother, you would do your best to rescue them.
That's why Yokota continues to tell his sister's story and to visit Washington, D.C. to enlist the help of U.S. officials. He was even part of a delegation that met President Trump in November 2017. A few months before that meeting, at his speech before the U.N. General Assembly, Trump spoke about a sweet 13-year-old Japanese girl who was kidnapped by North Korea. That was the same speech when he called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man. But Trump made no mention of the abductees during his speech at the UN last week. He thanked Chairman Kim for his courage and for the steps he's taking, adding that much work remains to be done. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
Ibi's story was supported by the Japan Center for International Exchange. Today was the day we were supposed to hear this.
The Nobel Prize in Literature is awarded to...
Now, right there, we normally would have heard the name of a writer, the winner of the esteemed Nobel Prize in Literature. But that did not happen today. The Swedish Academy, which awards the prize, is engulfed in a sexual abuse and corruption scandal, and it canceled this year's honor. The usual selection process for the Literature Nobel is not very transparent, and that got us thinking, what if everyone got to vote? So we want to hear from you. What author would you pick for a Nobel Literature Prize this year? Give us a call and let us know. Just leave us a message with your selection at 857-285-4157, and we might feature your pick on air. Again, that number is 857-285-4157. Meanwhile, here's a perfect story for a non-Nobel Literature Prize day. Katrina Lally has received the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature from Trinity College Dublin. That's one of Ireland's top literary honors. The prize committee described her novel Eggshells as a work of impressive imaginative reach. Lally is perhaps not a typical winner of the Rooney Prize for several reasons. To start with, Eggshells is the first work she's had published. We'll get to the other reason in a second, and we'll hear about it from Katrina Lally herself. We tracked her down in Dublin. She told me she wrote Eggshells a few years ago in the depths of Ireland's recession, when her own future looked bleak.
I had been laid off from my job, and I found myself wandering around Dublin, so looking for jobs online, but also looking for the staff wanted signs in shops. And there were no staff wanted signs. So I started noticing street signs with letters missing, and I wrote them down in a notebook, and then came up with this character who was noting these street signs down with letters missing and trying to find some kind of significance or meaning in them. And then this character of Vivian came to me, this oddball, socially isolated character who was wandering Dublin looking for kind of a portal to another world where she'd belong, and just looking at graffiti and place names and looking for meaning anywhere.
Vivian, your protagonist, her parents tell her she was left behind by a fairy when their real biological daughter was stolen. That notion that some children were stand-ins for a parent's actual son or daughter, that's something that some Irish kids were told historically, right?
Yeah. It had its place in Irish mythology years back. If a child started to act kind of strangely or differently, the parents often explained it as, oh, it's a changeling. A fairy came and, you know, replaced the real child with a fairy child. The idea kind of struck me years ago as the ultimate in not belonging, that a changeling child believes she doesn't belong in this world.
How much did you see yourself in Vivian? Is she kind of a proxy for you?
I think I took my feelings of not belonging to extreme with Vivian. Yeah, like, you know, when you're laid off from your job, suddenly your day that had structure and colleagues and this, you know, organized routine, it's suddenly your day is empty and you're kind of aimlessly wandering and you don't have that structure of meeting colleagues and having a break time with them or lunchtime. So that definitely was the spark for it. I took it to extreme, though. Like, Vivian is quite unusual. She has a lot of quirks and eccentricities. So, for example, she doesn't wash. She has no concern for her appearance. She takes things very literally and has no filter in her conversations. So it was just this kind of mischievous urge you might have to kind of tell a lie. Vivian just kind of runs with it.
Well, the other reason you're not a typical winner of the Rooney Prize, and this has been much touted in the media, is your job. You're a janitor at Trinity College in Dublin, the same institution that awards this prize.
Yeah, that's the day job. So I've been working there as a cleaner since 2015. I studied English literature in Trinity, 15 years ago now, and I spent my summers working there as a cleaner. And we used to spring clean student residences after they'd vacated them. And then I stayed friends with some of the women. And in 2015, these friends told me that Trinity was hiring again. So I decided to go back to work there, thinking cleaning would work well with my writing.
So can we hear the voice of the custodian somewhere in Eggshells or in Vivian?
I mean, maybe the outsider character always appeals to me because... like, the cleaner is generally invisible and goes unnoticed, and kind of you can observe things. The book I'm working on now, my second novel, there is a man in it working as a cleaner. When you're not noticed and sometimes not respected, it's good to see the world from a different perspective, I think.
Tell me more about that. I mean, what insight did that give you?
Well, I found it fascinating because I started working as a cleaner just a couple of months before Eggshells was published. And, you know, when you publish a book, you have a book launch party and you're being feted and interviewed and reviewed and, you know, your photos being taken. Like, you're treated like a kind of minor celebrity for a month or so. And then the day job was going in and working as a cleaner and being often ignored. I work in a university, so you get to know the administration staff and the lecturers, who are really decent people and will get to know your name. But sometimes, you know, students can literally look through you. And I found that fascinating, that you're kind of somehow subhuman or not good enough to kind of say good morning to. Mm. So I think it's kind of useful to keep your feet on the ground.
Yeah. It sounds like Dublin is itself a character in your book. Was Dublin kind to you as you were writing it?
I think it felt like the opposite to me at the time, because I was unemployed and I couldn't find this job that I was looking for. And things seemed to be just grey and bleak, like there was shops with shutters on them. And for me, it was almost a conscious decision to have Vivian seek this magic in the city, to try and look at the city differently, because I was feeling quite negative towards it. So when Vivian finds this map, like she writes down this list of place names that sound quite magical to her.
What do you think people get wrong about Dublin, especially people who don't know Dublin that well?
I suppose there's this idea that we're all kind of great writers and speakers, and the pub scene, I suppose, would be quite famous. So, yeah, Dubliners do like a drink. But I think, yeah, we do more than just drink and speak.
So the stereotype is that Irish are great storytellers. So can you walk into a pub and just hear a great story?
Yeah, like the women I work with, I mean, sometimes I feel I should not be the writer that a lot of these women should. Like I can write things, but they're fantastic storytellers in my work. And they've, you know, lived through so much.
You mean the women janitors work with?
Yeah, the janitors, exactly. There's just some really interesting life stories that, I mean, it would be fascinating to collect them all, but in their own voice, you know, to keep their voices.
Well, it sounds like you've got a great font of inspiration there, and many more novels to come, I hope.
Hopefully, yeah. In a new setting, probably. I think I've written Dublin to death.
Katrina Lally has received the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature from Trinity College Dublin. Her latest book is called Eggshells. She's at work on another novel. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks a million for having me. Lovely chatting to you. I am giving you a long love. Every day, every day,
every day, every day, every day, every day I write the book. Yeah, just the ticket we needed to come out of that interview. This is Winston Reedy's 1986 cover of a tune by Elvis Costello, Every Day I Write the Book. We're with you 5 days a week from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.